former VP of Google, once declined an otherwise brilliant job applicant at Google because they had once gotten a C in a math class, even though the rest of their grades were straight A's. Clearly, in today's competitive world, academic success matters. The bar must be set high for academic success, as well as creativity, innovation, and collaboration. But what about the kids that are not cut out to be the Renaissance children of the next generation? What about those kids, even those from privileged families, whose interests lie elsewhere? Whose job is it to see to it that they too are educated well and steered towards important places in our society? We're going to talk about exactly this today with my guest, Dr. Madeline Levine. She's a clinician, a consultant, and an educator. She's the author of the bestseller, The Price of Privilege. She's a co-founder of Challenge Success, a project birthed at the Stanford School of Education. And it is my pleasure to have her back on this program to talk about her newest work, Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success, Why Values and Coping Skills Matter More Than Grades, Trophies, or Fat Envelopes. Dr. Madeline Levine, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Good to have you back here. One of the things that really sort of stands out as you think about all of this, all that you wrote about in Price of Privilege and now in Teach Your Children Well, is that for all our supposed creativity and imagination, we have a pretty limited and small view of what success really means.
Absolutely. You know, you had a nice introduction there, and I was thinking as I was listening to you that this idea of kids who will be spectacularly successful and Google turns somebody down because they had one bad grade and stuff, and it hits me over and over again that we are talking about such a narrow range of kids that... You know, when I was in school, I'm sure when you were in school, everybody knew the kid who was just brilliant and went on to do not necessarily brilliant things, but went on to the high-prestige college and stuff like that. But we're talking about a sliver of America's children. And the fact that we still haven't really figured out a place for most of our children, I think is tragic, because you don't let anybody else into the tent except for the straight-A student. First of all, you have a pretty empty tent. And second of all, you leave an awful lot of kids standing outside with very little direction. And I do think that if we moved away from this, you know, just zeitgeist, it's everywhere in the culture that what you want to do is go to a top private school and go to a top college and then, I don't know, go work for Goldman Sachs or something like that. I mean, that is one narrow vision of success, and we all know CEOs that are miserable, and we know carpenters that are happy, and there is no school or no profession that either guarantees success or doesn't guarantee it. You
know? The other part of it, not to make this at all a political conversation, but sort of going to your point in terms of this small sliver that much of this vision of success represents, it's a little like the 1% of kids versus the other 99%.
You're absolutely right. And go right ahead and make it political, because I think it's got a lot of politics in it. And even in that 1% of, you know, the children of the 1%, there's something called the bell curve, and, you know, anybody
right.
who took Psych 101, even in that group, you're going to find a huge range of kids with different kinds of skills, and they will not all go on to be part of the 1% in themselves. And the real issue for me is, why do we only have a 1%? I mean, that's a whole other program, but
right. The
bifurcation of wealth and privilege in this country is becoming intolerable. And I think that it feeds on parents' anxiety that if their kids aren't in that 1%, which is unlikely because by definition it's only 1%, feeds on their anxiety that their kids are going to, you know, spending the rest of their life flipping burgers and living on the basement couch.
Right, and we've somehow aligned this vision of wealth and success with educational success as only defined by grades and high-stakes testing and everything else that goes along with it, and the fat envelope, as you say.
Right, which is, you know, as I think adults have this secret from kids, and this is the secret I think we have, that in real life, I'm a basketball fan, so I always say we go to our right, meaning we go to our strong side.
Uh-huh.
And it's really easy for me to be on the phone with you. I enjoy it. It's your career. I assume you enjoy it as well. But there's a host of things that we, or let me speak for myself, there's a host of things that I'm absolutely average at and a bunch of things that I'm really miserable at. So I've kept auditoriums with thousands of people waiting because I couldn't find my way back from the green room to the stage, you know, because my visual spatial abilities are very limited. So I didn't become a surgeon, right? So I went to my strength, which was verbal, and you know, have had a happy and successful career in something I really love. And I think when we talk to kids about you can't get a C, it's like almost like a delusion to me, because there are very few people in this world who are equally capable at absolutely everything they do.
By setting up this paradigm for success early on in these kids, do we risk suppressing the ability of the kids to really find out what their interests might be?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the things that always interests me is this concern that if I don't start my child in soccer at 6 or 7, then they will not be playing in the select traveling team at 12. And I think that example sort of captures the rock and the hard place that parents feel they're in. But the truth is they may not, because we're set up in this kind of crazy way where kids start prematurely. But the flip side of that is that every medical organization, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Orthopedics, all say that children should not be specializing in a sport at 6 or 7 or 8 or 9. The psychological point of view is that childhood is a time for exploration. So if all you do is soccer, you may miss the fact that, you know, basketball was your true sport or your true love. And in terms of physical damage, those are young kids whose bones are still growing, the number of repetitive injuries, Tommy John surgery. My own kid, who's now 30, so it's a long time ago before they had any protection, had knee surgery at 18 because he was a catcher before they had those pads behind the catcher's legs. So I think, you know, this is sort of the iconic problem for parents, which is, in the short term, you may put your child at a disadvantage if you think it's a huge advantage to be on a traveling team, which personally I don't. But and I had two kids on it, so I speak from experience. If you think that that's the end game, then your child may not be on that team if you don't let him specialize till he's 11 when everybody else started at 7. On the other hand, it's a very short-term view, and I think, in general, this short-term view is what's killing us all. It's the same view that corporate America has, like, you know, how do my numbers look at the end of the quarter, and we're like, how do our kids' numbers look at the end of the day? You know, what'd you get on your test at the end of the grading period? And I think parents are faced with a difficult decision about whether or not they're going to go for the short-term gain or the long-term gain. As a psychologist, I got to tell you, it's the long-term view that really counts.
How did we get to this point, and is it worth looking at how we got to this standard definition of success?
You know, it's a question I get asked a lot, and I have a partial answer, because I think, like all shifts in the culture, any culture, it's, you know, vector forces, all kinds of things change. So here are some of the things that I think changed. I think that somewhere in the 80s, we had a, you know, during the tech boom, everybody could be a millionaire, right? I was taking stock tips from my stockbroker, but also from my florist, right? And also from the shoemaker, because everybody, you know, was an authority on it, and everybody had a chance of becoming practically overnight millionaires. So I think we had a shift in what counts, you know, what's valuable. And what's valuable became money in a way it had never been before. And often people will say, well, that's not true. You know, the American dream, Horatio Alger, that's always been the American dream. But that's not accurate. If you go back and look at Horatio Alger's stories, they're all about stability and rising to the middle class. They are not about becoming, you know, phenomenally wealthy. They're about becoming a functional, good citizen, a solid citizen of the middle class. So I do think that's a shift. I think it was brought on by the fact that money became accessible to anybody. Fortunes were made overnight. As a result, you know, we had a spate of programs like Cribs and Pimp My Ride and a little later My Super Sweet 16, sort of extolling for kids the virtues of making a lot of money. You know, I often think my husband's leaving next week for Guatemala. He does third world medicine. And I've often thought it's just as easy to make a show about that and they go into the jungle and many kids go with them. My three sons have all gone with these teams. You could make a show about that, but that's not what was happening. You know, it was kind of The Simpsons where kids were running the show and adults were idiots. So there was this just general cultural shift. And I think moms, and I include myself in this, were really at sea. We didn't have role models about how to have our careers and our children. And I think in a way we professionalized motherhood so that we thought the same skills that would work in the office, you know, would work in parenting, and some of them do and a lot of them don't. And so I just think there was, and then of course China and the flat world. And
but it's interesting about China and the flat world and competition, because when we grew up in the age of Sputnik, it was a similar kind of competition. There was the sense that we had to be successful as individuals and therefore as a country in order to deal with, you know, the Soviet threat
right.
at the time. So there was the same kind of competition in some ways, but it had a very different impact.
It had a different impact, and I think it was framed entirely differently. I think, you know, because I'm near Silicon Valley, so I have lots of opportunities to speak with CEOs. I work at Stanford. I birthed a project called Challenge Success down there as a co-founder. And so, I have a lot of access to talking to people and CEOs. And the number one thing I hear, well, I hear many things, but one of the number one things I hear is there's no collaboration. And I think that in the Sputnik era, which I remember well, so that puts you and I in
right.
the same category. It was a sense of national pride. It was something we were all going to do together. It was about America, right? America can't be beaten by the Ruskies, as I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became something that didn't, I think, I don't have any memory of being pitted against other kids. I have a really strong memory of teachers talking about how we all had to do our best and work hard. And I think now what all these CEOs say are missing is collaboration, social skills, the ability to lead. A friend of mine, Tim Kugel, who used to be the original CEO of Yahoo, always says, what we're missing and what's critical is the ability to create the conditions for collaboration. And I think in this very individualistic, I'm going to make a fortune, you know, I mean, it's all over politics now. I'm going to make a fortune, kind of to hell with you. And it's very different than the collaborative feeling that I think we had during the Sputnik era.
The other is the loss of realization, or maybe we never had it. That those kids that are extremely talented, extremely smart, gifted, whatever you want to say, that they will do well no matter what.
There are a group of kids who are incredibly resilient and incredibly academically talented and very internally driven, and they do just fine. I would say that for the majority of kids, that's not the case. And the numbers that are coming in, we just got another report from the government on depression and anxiety disorders. They're doubling. They're tripling. Suicide is tripling. Self-mutilation on Ivy League campuses is 17%. That's like one out of five kids is going back and cutting themselves up. Substance abuse, not use, is 25% on our campuses. I mean, you can't ignore, you know, people sometimes give me a hard time about the word epidemic, but this actually meets the CDC's definition of an epidemic of mental health problems. Now, can they all be laid at the foot of academic stress and unrealistic expectations? No. But, for example, kids who have always felt stressed to some degree, right? Even when we were playing in our backyard, there's always been a level of stress in life. Always said that either their family, right, their parents are arguing, or their peers, I wasn't allowed to sit at the lunch table today, were the greatest stressors in their lives. Now, kids say, by far, the greatest stressor in their life is school. You know, whereas for many of us, school used to be kind of a retreat. It was an exciting and interesting place. Not every teacher was great. I don't want to romanticize it. But to say that far and away the greatest stressor in a child's life is school now, I think we have to take a look at that system. And, you know, the fact that everybody can point to a kid who is doing well in spite of it all, you know, belies the fact that behind that kid there's a kid in rehab, you know, there's a kid who's, you know, just folded their cards and decided not to play. There are the kids that we don't see because they're running into trouble. So I think, you know, yes, we turn out some incredibly talented kids, but that's kind of like risk-reward. Is you have to know your child incredibly well to know whether you're running too much risk or if it's really worth the reward.
And that gets to one of the key things that you come back to repeatedly in Teach Your Children Well, is that one size doesn't fit all, essentially, that you do have to know your child well, and there is not one path, one method that suits all these kids.
Well, of course not. And I think that part of the problem is that we ourselves, I don't think part of the problem, I think a lot of the problem is that we ourselves are so overwhelmed. We're so, you and I talked before the show about, you know, not getting enough sleep mm-hmm. last night. We're so pressured. We're so pushed. We have so much to do. Technology has come in and has surpassed any ability to understand how to use it well or not, right? It's just moving so quickly that, you know, the standard question, should my child be on Facebook and should my child be texting it? And the answer is, I don't know, because we haven't had it long enough to really look at the impact of technology on kids. So I think parents are just as stressed. The economy's terrible. Everybody's worried. And it's very hard to get to know your child well if you spend all week, you know, kind of racing around and back to your sports thing, and then spend the weekend, you right. know, sitting passively in the bleachers watching a bunch of kids bat a ball. I mean, I think it's a very unappealing view of what adulthood is.
Do we need to find other ways and other metrics by which to measure success? Because we're always looking for something to measure by. Do we need to find simply a substitute, a different set of metrics?
Well, we might start by questioning why we need to measure everything, because didn't Einstein say something like, I wish I had it right, you know, the things that don't matter can always be measured,
right.
and the things that matter can't be measured.
Can't be, right.
So our infatuation with measurement, I mean, we're that kind of country. We like to measure things and see how we're doing. But I don't want to ever sound like I'm anti-intellectual or anti-good grades or even anti-testing. That's not the point. The point is that it is one way. And, you know, there are whole countries now that are doing these happiness assessments of their country, where they
mm-hmm.
stand,
right.
not on GDP, but on happiness. I mean, I don't know that we can do that as a country, although, since we're the same generation, remember our report cards used to say, it used to have the grades on one side, and on the other side, it had plays well with others.
Right.
Right? So what happened to that? You know, what happened to thinking that one's participation as a citizen, as a friend, as a student in other than academics counted? So, you know, yeah, I think we could bring back things like plays well with others, because the business community, which is the end game for all of this, right? We want our kids to have jobs. The business community is saying plays well with others is really, really important.
To one extent, there's a lot of this, and you talk about this, happening really early on. I mean, the difference, for example, in academic-based versus play-based preschools, right, and the way this kind of sets the stage.
Right. So this notion that earlier is better and faster is better is so out of line with, you know, child development's been around for a long time, and while psychology, I would say, you know, it's a hard field to do assessment in because there are so many variables in a person, but we've had, you know, 100 years almost of looking at child development, and I think that we know that you really can't rush child development. You can't force child development, and so we get sold a bill of goods. You know, Disney puts out Baby Einstein, which I talk about in Teaching mm-hmm. Children Well, right? And every third household with a child has a Baby Einstein video, which is billed as educational. Well, the fact is that the research shows that it actually retards language acquisition by 10% in babies and toddlers. Well, we never heard about that, right? Because the University of Washington, where most of this research was done, they don't have the resources to compete against a corporation like Disney. So this information, which has been known for quite some time, only becomes really public last year, when Disney had to take the word educational off its videos and offer a refund. So there are ideas out there, like, you know, if your kid reads earlier, that's great. You know, that's going to give them a leg up. And in fact, there's a big body of research that says it makes no difference down the road a couple of years whether your child read at 4 or 5 or 6 or 7, which is when they just start school in Finland, which is considered uh-huh. the exemplar of education in the world right now. So there's no benefit to rushing kids. I just read an article, Jeff, that I thought was going to drive me up the wall. It was in The Atlantic. It was called The Data-Driven Parent.
Right.
I don't know if you saw it.
I did see it, yes.
Yeah, you did. And I wrote a rebuttal, and it wasn't printed. It made me so mad. It's kind of like, great, you can monitor every, you know, movement, poop, sound, turnover, you know, whatever of your child. What good does that do you? Leaving aside, you know, kids with very significant problems, a normal child does not need to be spied on and have this kind of oversight from the moment they're born. I think it's like a crazy idea, and I think it, just like you said, it sets the stage for thinking that good parenting is about constant oversight, and nothing could be further from the truth.
And it just becomes, I mean, the rest of the discussion, which we were having earlier in terms of colleges, in terms of success, becomes not just about data, but about how do you then monetize everything that you've done in the kid's life.
Right. That's right. And, you know, and it's now it's really quite sad. I mean, people have to pull their kids out of the private schools that they were certain was going to guarantee their kids' lives. You know, if you look at the Fortune 500, they didn't go. The vast majority did not go to Ivy League schools. They went to state schools. I went to a state school. Many people I know went to state schools. And they did an interesting study at Yale of kids who had been accepted there and who went, and then kids who were accepted and didn't go and went to far less prestigious schools. They didn't have the money or mom was sick or whatever. And they found 20 years down the line there was no difference in income and there was no difference in life satisfaction with work. So, you know, our notion that this is the road to success is just littered with misconceptions. And, you know, I hate seeing parents literally mortgaging their houses and in many ways mortgaging their lives because that's their asset so that their kid can go to a school two notches up on the U.S. World and News, you know, nonsense. When at the end of the day, it makes very little difference or no difference.
Of course, because so much of it is aspirational, even when you get outside some of these privileged communities or upper middle class communities, you find these same attitudes trickling down into virtually every aspect of the society.
Well, I think that's true. And of course, you know, America's always been about each generation does better than the next. So, you know, my grandfather was a bricklayer from Russia and my father was a policeman and I'm a PhD. And then the assumption is that my kids are going to be what? You know, at some point, that's not going to happen. I was reading yesterday that it's going to be the first generation that does not have home ownership at the rate that we had home ownership. So will there be a tremendous slowing down in this country? It looks that way. I just came back. I was speaking at Aspen Ideas Festival, and it was not a happy group. It was a lot of fun, and it was very interesting, but in terms of projections for this country. And so it seems to me, and again, this is the clinician in me, that anytime you walk into a situation, an unknown, turbulent, you can see I was on a plane last night, you know, just a up-in-the-air kind of situation, those are exactly the times when you need a particular skill set. You need to be flexible. You need to be resilient. I mean, it's a whole other skill set to get you through times when we don't know 5 years from now, we have no idea what the major jobs are going to be.
Right.
Just none. I was on a panel with one of the chief engineers of NASA in Denver a few weeks ago, and he told me that 6 years ago, 8 of the top jobs at NASA did not exist.
It's interesting you talk about home ownership because that also goes to the heart of this, not only in economic terms, but part of the drag of home ownership is that it impedes mobility, which is going to be more critical for the next generation in terms of being able to move around to find where the jobs are as situations on the ground change.
Right. Right. And also, I wish I could remember where I read it, but it was either Newsweek or one of those magazines talking about how this country, in fact, has less social mobility than any other, at this point, less social mobility than any other westernized country. So, you know, we're left with this leftover notion of, you know, all things are possible. You know, you just put your shoulder to the grindstone and everything is possible. But in fact, we have less opportunity to change social class here than in any other westernized country.
And in fact, that may very well be one of the things that is feeding into this. I mean, the fear that the 1% has about that very fact. And not wanting to lose that advantage and that privilege.
Right, but they leave in their way. I mean, you know, I'm one of that 1%, but we leave in our wake our own children. I have 3 kids, and, you know, talking about different kinds of kids, I had an analytic thinker, a creative thinker, and a hands-on thinker, and not surprisingly, my analytic thinker became a lawyer, and not surprisingly, my creative kid is in New York, you know, being what we call a actor, director, waiter, a caterer, a tutorer.
Right.
Depending on what's going on. And my youngest is still in college. And, you know, I feel because I've seen that for one of the 3 kids, life in terms of work is so much easier. Although, luckily, he graduated a few years ago. I guess half the lawyers now are graduating without jobs. But we can't, you know, you can't just have 7 or 8 or 10 jobs. Kids come in such variety of talents and abilities and interests. And my creative son, who I just saw back in New York, every once in a while when I get really nervous about what he's doing, I'll say something like, well, Michael, you know, have you ever thought about the business end of theater? He's a theater rat. You know, he loves theater. He does mostly directing theater. And, you know, it's very off and on. And I'll say, you know, have you thought about the business end? And he'll look at me and he'll go, aren't you the lady who wrote See the Child in Front of You? It's sort of like, I did, but, you know, like you're my own kid. And, you know, it takes me a minute to understand. He's never going to, he says, what do you want me to do, go get an MBA? I mean, this is a kid who lives for the theater. So, you know, I think we run the risk of crushing kids by trying to fit them into slots that they're just not made for, not genetically made for. Not in terms of their capacities, not in terms of their interests, and that's back to the bigger tent.
Dr. Madeline Levine, the book is Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. Madeline, it's always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Yeah, terrific interview. Thank you.
Thank you.